Today's Undisclosed Addendum is brought to you by our most comfortable sponsor, Mack Weldon. Make sure you go to MackWeldon.com and get yourself some threads. Listen in later in the show for the spot from Mack Weldon, and make sure to support our sponsor because Mack Weldon supports us. Until then, enjoy the show.
Hello, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. I am John Cryer, and you are listening to the podcast about all things undisclosed. In episode 11 of Undisclosed, Propensity, we moved on from Joey and Isaac's prior difficulties to their prior transactions, the incidents that the state alleged were so close to the murder of Isaac Dawkins that they proved that Joey Watkins was the only one who could have killed him. Now, with us today is one of the hosts of Undisclosed, Colin Miller. He's an associate dean and professor of law at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he blogs at Evidence Prof Blog. Say hey, Colin.
Hey, John. How's it going?
Real good. Real good. Thanks for being here once again. But we also have guests this week. First of all, we have Amber Hunt. She is an award-winning journalist and a New York Times best-selling author who works as a special projects reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. She has written four nonfiction books and teaches multimedia journalism at the University of Cincinnati. Amber is also the host of The Accused podcast, which I just started listening to and unfortunately cannot stop listening to.
Thank you. So,
thank you for being here, Amber. And with Amber is Amanda Rossman. She's an Emmy Award-winning photojournalist with the Cincinnati Inquirer, a graduate of Northern Kentucky University. She has worked for the Inquirer for 10 years. And in that time, she's won several awards from the Ohio News Photographers Association and the Associated Press. Amanda is the producer of The Accused podcast. So welcome, Amanda.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I just started listening to The Accused podcast, and it centers around the Elizabeth Andes case, which was a murder in Oxford, Ohio in 1978, I believe. Now, given that there was a lot of much higher profile murder cases at that time that you mentioned actually in the podcast, what drew you to her case?
Well, first off, hers is unsolved, so that's one of the first things. But beyond that, it started that we were just going to look at her case as maybe a Sunday 1A story that we just kind of dig into what happened. But the more that we dug, the more we found that there were really unusual circumstances around the investigation itself. And then that sort of spiraled into what ultimately became the podcast.
Actually, can I ask you guys to give us a little background on the case, what crime occurred, and exactly how that all went down?
The podcast looks at the 1978 murder of Elizabeth Andes. She had just graduated from Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. She was in the process of moving out of an apartment that she shared with a girlfriend, that girl's boyfriend, and Beth's own boyfriend, Bob Young. So the night of December 28th, Bob drives to the apartment to help her pack and move. And when he comes in, he finds her body on the bedroom floor. She's been strangled. She's tied up. She's got what he thinks are bullet wounds in her chest. They turn out to be stab wounds. And within half an hour, he was taken into police custody and questioned. And 15 hours into that interrogation, he confessed. He signed a statement saying that he did it. But two juries, one civil and one criminal, found him not guilty and not liable.
Does he say exactly what led him to confess? I know sort of generally he says he was under pressure, it was 15 hours, et cetera, but does he go into more detail at all in that?
We talked to him a bit more about that coming up, but he basically, it went from, you know you did it, to if you just say you did it, I know people have gotten out for 2 years for these crimes of passion. So he was just feeling trapped. And on top of that, he was traumatized from, he just found this woman that he loved dead on the floor and he hadn't slept. He was brought in at 9:30, 10 p.m. and he didn't confess until 1 p.m. the next day. He has a hard time explaining it now to other people. He says, you know, I never expected to see anything like that in my life. I don't know how other people would react, but it's how I reacted. Of course, he's regretful, but he beats himself more up because he wasn't there to save her in the first place. But the interesting thing for me on this case has been that, not that he was charged and found not guilty and not liable, but that the police and prosecutors are dead set that they had the right guy and they refused to look at anybody else. And we've found through our reporting, it's not us, you know, just being biased by any means. This is a year of our life. We found through the reporting that there were people that they should have talked to further.
Well, I think there's been a sea change in people's understanding of false confessions. I know during the 70s, when I was growing up, a confession was not considered, you didn't even consider the fact that it might be false. You felt like, oh, there it goes. It's only been, honestly, it's very recent for me, and I, you know, have been immersed in true crime for years. The ubiquity of false confessions was a revelation to me. I mean, I cited a statistic on that ages ago that 25% of DNA exonerees confessed. So that means that 25% of innocent people that the cops drag in and interrogate could well make a confession. You know, that's a remarkable statistic. It explains, obviously, the Central Park Five, who were all convicted on the basis of false confessions. I can see, though, back in 1978, when this occurred, though, I mean, the other police officers taking it at face value.
Right, right. And I do understand that, too. And, you know, Bob Young's own defense lawyer had never dealt with a false confession before and wasn't comfortable with it at the beginning. But when the details within the confession don't match up, when there's so much wrong with it, all I'm saying is, like, it doesn't make sense to me why after the jury acquits, you wouldn't look again. Just look again.
But we're dealing with the police officers with limited resources and time, and they probably feel like they have other things that are more urgent that they look into other than this guy who was probably guilty.
I don't know what Oxford, Ohio had that was more urgent than murder in a quarter century.
Right. But this is right what you get to in the first episode, though, is that in this case, because Bob was exonerated, he successfully moved to have the records of his case sealed. And somehow it seems that the police then took that as, well, the records are sealed, we can't reopen the investigation.
Yeah, they took it as that they couldn't even look at the file. Yeah.
Which is a very strange interpretation of that law.
It feels like a convenient interpretation for people who don't want to do it.
Yeah. And that's why the podcast, I think, is so essential. I'm so glad that you two have done this because, yeah, it is a case where it's not just in the back burner. It literally wouldn't have been investigated again if not for the two of you stepping in and looking into all these fascinating pieces of evidence that weren't explored.
And it seems like the podcast is delving deeper into how the murder resonated amongst all the other people surrounding Beth Andes, and also going into how the investigation went wrong. It's very interesting because in a lot of ways, The Accused is kind of a mirror podcast to Madeline Barron's In the Dark podcast, because hers is a case where the investigation went wrong in so many ways that the case remained unsolved for decades. And yours tells the story of an investigation that supposedly solved the case, but did it so quickly that it now remains unsolved. So have you listened to In the Dark at all?
I have started it. To be honest, we've been in a war room for the past year, so I think I just figured out yesterday that there's an election going on. But the first episode was gripping.
And the fact that it remains unsolved is actually a matter of opinion in some respects, because many of the police officers involved in the case believe that the Elizabeth Andy case was in fact solved, but that the perpetrator was simply not convicted. Or rather, they feel that on the basis of what appears to be a false confession. And in so many cases of false confession, they are in fact convicted. How was Bob Young, the accused in this case, able to actually not be convicted in this case?
There were two ways. One was that the details in his confession actually didn't match the crime scene. And he says, thank goodness for that. The other way, though, actually relates to your episode 10, where you're looking at character. They didn't have any character witnesses coming up and talking about how terrible a guy Bob Young was. I think that we are very lucky that we aren't writing about or talking about somebody who has been in prison since 1979. And I think a big reason is because he wasn't a bad guy to begin with, and they had a hard time making the jury think that he could have done this.
Right. He even took the stand in his case.
Which is highly unusual.
Right.
Do you have video of the trial where he's testifying?
Unfortunately, we do not. Cincinnati, the TV stations all kind of give their archives to this Cincinnati Museum Center. And right now, the museum is undergoing renovations. So we weren't able to access any of the archives.
But was it actually videotaped? Because to me, I recall the 70s not being a time when video cameras were welcomed in a lot of courtrooms. Were the proceedings actually taped?
The proceedings, I don't think so. There was coverage of it, and there is reference in one of the transcripts to audio recordings, but they can't be located. We can't find them. So I read 1,000 pages of trial transcript, and that's how I recreated the trial in my head.
Right, and when we know the Enquirer's photographers were there at the time because we did have a few photos from the trial.
One thing I noticed in the podcast was you started to get into the effect of looking into this case on you, Amber, and on living with all this stuff on a daily basis. Did that surprise you that it was affecting you so deeply?
I've been a crime reporter for about 20 years. I always get drawn back to crime, and it's always hard. I remember having breakdowns when I was covering crime in Detroit where, you know, there'd be a 12-year-old and I'd be at the scene and his brains would still be on the sidewalk. Yeah, it affects you. But there was still something about this one that caught me off guard. And I think it was because I didn't just delve into the case, but I looked at the time and the other cases that were happening at the same time. It made me feel very uncomfortable. Very insecure. So yeah, it was a surprise.
Well, also just playing that soundbite of Ted Bundy was one of the creepiest things I've ever heard. I was driving and I started getting chills up my spine, which wasn't helpful to my driving, I have to say. But you mentioned also that podcasting is a different medium than journalism and that you're actually having to step out of what you've been trained for years to do as a journalist, which is be objective, and you have to tell sort of a personal narrative. How difficult has that been for you?
It was tough. Amanda got the luxury of not having to jump in too often, although you do hear her a few times throughout the podcast. But for me, I mean, I've written first person pieces like travel stories. I knew early on that we were going to have to get a little more personal than I like to with this piece, though, because it's such an intimate format. I mean, you want people to allow you in their heads for 45 minutes at a time. And it just felt like it would feel weird if I didn't let down my guard a little bit. So that was difficult for me to get used to, but I think it was necessary.
Now, would you classify this still as journalism per se, because it, you know, it now is narrated in the first person?
Yeah, I absolutely still think it's journalism. I think it's not in a format that I would put in print, but we'll have a print component that will be more traditional. For me, the amount of investigating that went into it and the fact that I did keep an open mind throughout all of this and followed all of the same principles that I always follow as a journalist, I mean, I think it definitely qualifies.
Yeah, I think it gives listeners an active view into the process. You know, people can actually come along and see how things were brought to us and how we got little pieces of information.
It's more honest, really, because you get that insight. The process didn't change. You just see more of it.
Right.
In a way, it's more transparent.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned that character evidence of the kind that's in the Joey Watkins trial was not brought into Bob Young's trial. Colin, perhaps this is a question for you. Are the laws different in Ohio than in Georgia?
Well, it's interesting because at the time of Joey's trial, Georgia was in fact an outlier. They didn't have a character evidence rule modeled after the federal rule. Ohio did, but the rules aren't that different, in that it is still that same rule where if it's propensity character evidence, you're just proving, you know, once a burglar, always a burglar, that can't come in. Whereas the evidence might be admissible to prove modus operandi, knowledge, motive, etc. And in fact, right in one of your episodes, you go into the whole MO, the modus operandi, because there's this guy, Nolan Ray George, who you mentioned in the podcast was sort of this renowned figure who committed all these crimes in the area. And you talked to a crime historian, Peter Vronsky, right, who was getting into the whole idea of MO with these serial killers. And the interesting thing is because, you know, John, as you mentioned in the episode, the whole theory of MO is we're not actually talking about the character of the defendant. We're talking about the character of the crime. And what I think that this guy, Peter Vronsky, this crime historian on Unaccused, does so well is to describe how MO really isn't a fixed thing. It's always morphing and shifting because a serial criminal is learning new things. They are, after they have committed certain crimes, changing the way they operate. So the whole idea of MO, I think, is blown out of proportion. We think that you really do have this signature for a crime, and in real life, it rarely is something you can pin down and say, oh, this is the MO of a particular criminal in a case.
I read up on Ted Bundy so much, and if you didn't know about his confessions, a lot of those cases you would be hard-pressed to connect. They're very different from each other.
Yes, because he used very different means in all of them. I understood that at some point he worked at a suicide hotline. So he was clearly sort of a student of understanding human manipulation. And he, you know, he changed in so many ways over the course of his criminal career.
Exactly.
Colin, actually, you used that wonderful MO explanation citing the kitchen sink bandits from Home Alone. By the way, Colin, it must be said, the breadth of your references from Greek mythology, the Scylla and Charybdis, to Shakespeare, to you dropped the mic on Heidi Klum and Seal a couple of weeks ago. That was just remarkable. You know, at first I thought, well, sometimes he cites things that are actually a little more complicated than the thing he's trying to explain. But the kitchen sink bandit thing worked great for me.
Okay, Undisclosed listeners, you are about to take part in the first ever online on-air shopping experience with Mack Weldon. I'm going to go to MackWeldon.com and purchase a shirt right while I'm reading this ad. Here we go. On the Mack Weldon page, they've got all their products listed horizontally across the top. I'm going to pick t-shirts and scroll down to V-neck because that's the style that I rock. I immediately come to a display of their 18-hour jersey in white. Beautiful, but not quite the color that I want. My style is true black, so I scroll to the right at the color palette and put my cursor over black, and boom, the display pops up with a beautiful true black t-shirt. My size is large, so I pick that, and boom, it's in my cart. Hey, you'll notice that before you check out, your cart pops up, and at the very bottom, they're going to give you an opportunity to put in a promo code right under checkout. Apply promo code undisclosed. You're going to get 20% off your order. After that, you're going to put in your shipping information, your shipping preference, and your credit card information. I am a repeat customer, so all of my info is already saved in there. Don't worry if you're not. It only takes a few seconds. You plug it in, you press submit, and your order is in. Very soon, you're going to have some real comfortable, real quality Mack Weldon threads right to your door. Listeners, the threads are quality. The website is simple. The shopping experience is so much better than anything you're going to get at a department store. You've got to go to Mack Weldon and try it. So go get you some. Go to MackWeldon.com, buy some gear, and plug in the promo code undisclosed. You're going to get 20% off your order. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code undisclosed.
Amanda and Amber, have you been listening to Undisclosed this season?
Yeah, we have.
Do you have any burning questions that you wanted to throw at Colin?
Yeah, actually, I'm curious, now that you guys are doing this, how are you handling the incoming tips? Because we're getting that now. And I'm not really sure, how do you weigh it out? Like, what's plausible, what will translate, and how do you
just
break it to somebody?
Yeah, I mean, it's really tough. I mean, we try where we can to find corroboration. There's a ton of stuff, both in Adnan's case and in Joey's case, where you'll have people coming in and they say something that has the sound of plausibility to it, but unless we can really get some type of external corroboration, we usually leave it on the cutting room floor. So that's sort of the key, is if you can cross-reference among witnesses and see whether multiple people remembered, if you can go into the files and do a deep dive and see, oh, wait, this person mentioned this, and I can find that in the file, some type of reference where contemporaneously they mentioned it, that's something that deserves further investigation. But yeah, there's a ton of sort of false leads that you maybe have an email string of five or six emails back and forth and then realize at the end, just not reliable enough to go with.
Yeah, we're finding that the aftermath here is just as much work as the initial legwork was.
Yeah, because this addendum will be airing Thursday at 6, and your last official episode, or at least planned episode, drops earlier that day or midnight on Wednesday. But are you finding new information that's going to lead to new episodes beyond those initial 8?
Well, I want to be careful not to push stuff out just to push it out. Mm-hmm. But we do have some follow-ups that we've already dug into, yeah. Whether it'll justify an entire episode or just a short update, I'm not sure yet. But we're still trying to work with law enforcement on following some of these tips, too.
Has their
Which
attitude-
is a weird position for a journalist.
Well, again, yeah, you're becoming part of the story, an active participant, and it's a new area for you, I would imagine.
It is, although, I mean, when I would cover crime in Detroit, I always made a point to get in touch with the investigators. If there was something that I learned that I needed to tell them as a human being. I always said I'm a human first and a journalist second. So I'm just following that here too.
And how long have you been working on the podcast?
For almost a year now, or even a little over a year, is when it first got brought to Amber. And then I became involved shortly after that.
I would say we knew we were working on a podcast probably in February.
Yeah.
But the story itself was brought to us last September.
So in this week's episode of Undisclosed, the team sort of painstakingly looked into the many incidents that the state used to convince the jury that Joey Watkins was the only one who wanted to kill Isaac. But what was unclear to me from this last week episode is which of these incidents actually got play in front of the jury, because a couple of them are described and then Susan would mention that, oh, this never got to the jury. So, you know, I know there was prior difficulties and prior transactions. Which of those did the jury actually hear?
They heard, I mean, there's, it's tough to remember exactly which ones, but like the Mount Berry Square incident, the incident where he supposedly punched Brianne, the Paul Allen situation at the barbecue, that's the one that actually was used in the appeal because there was this claim that Joey was chasing after Isaac and Paul Allen, but it turned out that he actually wasn't part of that transaction. So there was definitely a good amount of character evidence that was presented at trial. Not everything that Tammy Colston wanted in, but a majority of it did find its way to the jury.
And considering that, as you pointed out, a lot of this didn't seem to point out a specific MO, was it ever appealed on that basis, that it didn't meet that criteria?
No, there was no sort of generalized character evidence appeal to say this was a character assassination and it painted Joey in an unfair light. That would be a pretty tough one to prove on appeal. You really sort of have to point to specific evidentiary errors as opposed to just saying the totality of the character evidence painted this picture. I can say we've talked to a few jurors, and if you actually look at the case and see what led them to convict, they definitely got an impression of Joey from the character evidence that he was this person who had a short fuse, would go around, and would engage in violent activity. So I think it did have a big impact on the jury, but it's one of those things where once it comes in, it's really tough to appeal character evidence.
I have a question from social media from Stace German, which is, do the lawyers see a failure by the judge to keep his court free of BS in Joey's case? Any show of concern in transcripts? I guess they're asking, did his attorney strenuously object to all of this evidence that came in that was basically character evidence?
Yeah, we sort of have talked about this a bit the last two episodes where they really wanted to get a hearing. And that's what happens in most jurisdictions outside of Georgia is if the prosecutor wants to present evidence of other acts, you need to have a hearing outside the presence of the jury. You need to give defense counsel the chance to cross-examine these witnesses, because that's the problem that manifested here is you can't just rely upon the prosecution's claim witness X is going to testify to Y and it's going to prove Z. You need to have that witness there before the judge. The judge can actually assess, is this a credible witness? Did this incident occur? Does the testimony support the claim that the prosecution claims it supports? And that's what wasn't done here. And that's where you have a situation like in Joey's trial where what's claimed is often different than what's produced, and that can lead to some real prejudice for the defendant.
But it sounded like that there was a quirk in the Georgia legal system at that time that allowed a judge to take in evidence without any of those things. Is that correct?
It still exists now. Yeah, I mean, Georgia.
Oh.
And that was the exchange, getting to the question of, did Joey's attorneys express some consternation? They did. They objected and said, we'd like a hearing. We'd like to suss this out. And the judge, Judge Matthews, correctly said under Georgia law, and it's still the law today, we can rely upon the prosecution just simply standing up in front of the judge. You can have the prosecutor telling the judge, Your Honor, we have Jane Doe, and she's going to testify to this incident on October 1st, 2015, and it's going to prove that this defendant had a motive to harm the victim, and the judge can be satisfied by that and doesn't have to have a hearing where that witness actually is produced and actually has to have a proffer where they say, here's what I'm going to testify to.
I've got another question from Twitter. This from AlShep705, who asks, Rome is so small. Did Joey or Isaac have a beef with anyone else? Which I think is a good question, considering that the state attempted to prove that the only person who would have shot Isaac was Joey.
Yeah, I mean, definitely the state tried to present it as this is the only person who had a motive to harm Isaac. And, you know, it's tough to say because we're not back in 2000, so it's uncertain exactly the nature of Isaac's relationships with everyone. there wasn't anyone they could really point to say this would be a person with a specific motive to harm Isaac. That said, as we presented earlier in the season, this was a case where there were prior incidents of road rage involving Isaac, which a big alternate theory is that this was a road rage incident that someone shot at him based upon being unhappy the way he was driving. There was the case of Isaac being pulled over where the police mistook him for someone else who was engaged in criminal activity. And there was Isaac claiming very soon before he was shot that he thought someone was following him and he had written down the license plate number. And that would seem to point to someone having some animosity towards him. So no one really too specific we can point to, but, you know, some definite possibilities there for alternate realities as to what might have happened here.
Well, also, these are teenage relationships. You know, they're inherently volatile. They're teenage relationships. I mean, I love the story of how Mark Free and Joey met when Joey spat on his truck, to which Mark Free ran after him. And then the next time he saw Joey, he knocked him over. So they were best friends forever after that. You know, in that kind of volatile atmosphere, you can spin those situations any way that you want as a prosecutor. You know, obviously, I hope that Joey's defense actually made something of that. I imagine they did. I've got another one, another Twitter question that I was particularly entertained by. This from Aenor Settle, which says, how do y'all not just get on the mics and yell for 30 minutes? These cases are so frustrating. but it does. It goes to the question, you know, you're working on something that feels like a, you know, a serious injustice has occurred and you're working on this on a daily basis. Does it wear on you?
Yeah.
Is that
and,
for me?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry. You know, let's start with Amber and Amanda.
Yeah. I mean, that was the episode today. This is what? This is Tuesday, September 27th, and your episode 7 just premiered. And yeah, you can sort of describe some of what you've been going through.
Yeah. Yeah. We're tired. And I did notice that some people have described me as a bit aggressive in my questioning. But after, you know, a year of working on this and seeing that things weren't done, not even just right, because I'm fully aware that there are humans at the core of this and we're all going to make mistakes and stuff. But there are such systematic problems that there were times when I felt like yelling. Luckily, Amanda was there to reel me in.
To yell with you at the same
right.
time. But
you can yell in private.
Just,
and then
right, yeah. It just felt like one thing after another when we kept digging. And it's like, oh my gosh, then they missed this. And then this wasn't taken care of. And nobody talked to this guy, really? Nobody followed
and
up?
I'm the first person to make this phone call. Are you kidding me?
That's one of the issues I wanted to explore, actually, is... Yeah, I did see some of these comments, and they weren't necessarily negative. I think overwhelmingly the response to the podcast has been very positive, but whether they were negative or not, there were a string of comments I saw describing your style in investigating and interrogating as aggressive, and I was wondering, I didn't see that personally myself. Do you think that someone acting the exact same way as you, but a male involved in the investigation and interrogation, would get that same word used of aggressive?
I'm thinking that if a male reporter reached a level 10, they might finally be told that they're being too aggressive. I can only reach like a 4 or 5 because I'm female, and people get uncomfortable with it far sooner. But that's, you know, that's okay. I'm not here to be your friend. So, and there reaches a point. I mean, you know, we cut out the pleasantries at the beginning of the conversation because it doesn't forward the story. We were plenty nice. We were always nice. But there reaches a point when somebody is stonewalling you. Being too nice is probably what caused this case to linger for 40 years. Somebody's got to get mad on behalf of the family. So I guess I'm okay taking that role.
Do you ever feel like being female helps in a situation?
I think that they probably don't expect me to know the law. And while I'm not a lawyer, I've at least done enough research that I'm not totally stupid on the subject. And so, you know, they start talking about certain issues and I'm able to say, well, actually, I think that was already taken to the Supreme Court. And they have to check up on it. So that I think they're expecting me to be stupid, which is, of course, entirely insulting. But that can work to my advantage because they're thinking that they can say some BS and I'm not going to call them on it. And I absolutely am.
But I think, too, as far as talking with friends and family and some of these other folks, being female, I think you can almost even be a little bit more empathetic. And I don't know if that's a female trait, but we feel for these people. And I think that comes off as very genuine. I think that definitely helps.
I'm wondering, in terms of that whole use of the term aggressive, actually one interview where I thought especially you weren't aggressive and it was hugely helpful. And I'll say, John mentioned how much I drop pop cultural references, and I'm a conspicuous consumer of all this true crime media. I think I would say the most fascinating thing that I have seen or heard in any of these true crime podcasts, documentaries, etc., is the interview you did with Buzz Call, Elizabeth Andy's boss. It's just, could you talk, I guess, a bit about how you approached that interview, who Buzz Call is, and exactly how that interview went and what you were able to get out of him?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So, Buzz Call was the victim's manager. She worked at a little deli and he was her boss. And it wasn't brought up at trial, but when I was going through police statements, I noticed that he had filled one out and he said that the Wednesday night before she died on a Thursday, he had spent about 2.5 hours at her place. Now, I called him pretty early in the reporting because seeing that he spent 2.5 hours with her alone in her apartment, just the two of them, I was thinking, well, maybe she said that she was worried about somebody, you know. So I called him pretty innocently to just find out more information about how that went down. But there reached a point in the conversation when I felt he was maybe a little evasive. I'm trying to be PC here. So there reached a point where he was saying, I don't remember anything about it. And I just instinctively was like, really? Because she died the next day. Doesn't that stick? And then it was after that that we found out actually from the victim's friends that she was uncomfortable around him. They didn't know anything about him having spent 2.5 hours there. So it was a pretty interesting conversation. I wish he would call me back as I invited him to so that I could follow up. But it shined some light on at least one of the characters in this story.
And am I right on the timing of that? So he says he went over to her place and they watched TV. And you had the whole question of, is the TV out like in the living room or the bedroom? And was it that same night then that he says she came over to her place to use his phone to make a collect call because she was moving and her phone had been called out? Or was that a different night?
It's the same night.
So the night before she was killed, he says he went to her place and then later she goes to his place and then he, on his phone, she makes a collect call.
Right.
Do you remember what the collect call was or who she was calling, does he say?
We've asked
he
around. And no one remembers getting this call, but he says in his statement that he thought she was calling her parents.
Okay.
But the thing is, in 1978, when you're a college student and it's almost midnight, you don't call your parents. And apparently that was the case in this family. You would only call at midnight if it were an emergency. So it probably would have stuck in memory, but nobody remembers getting this phone call.
So part of this process, you know, obviously we're looking at all these cases in hindsight, both on Undisclosed and obviously Serial and In the Dark and The Accused. Are we learning really useful things from this? Because obviously in any human process, there's going to be errors. And you can always go, you know, 20 years down the way and say, oh, well, there was an error. You know, I get all these Twitter responses from people saying, why didn't the lawyers fight harder? And I'm sure they may have, but obviously they didn't fight in the right way or whatever. You know, are we really learning useful things from this?
I hope the right people are learning useful things from this.
Well, I do wonder if law enforcement listens to this kind of stuff. You know, obviously, I think the people who most important are law enforcement and juries. People who, although last week we were talking to Bill, who does the Breakdown podcast, and they were saying that jurors who actually listened to true crime broadcasts and podcasts were being excluded from juries, which to me is like exactly the opposite of what should be happening. I understand why lawyers would be uncomfortable with it. But now, and you mentioned actually in the podcast, Colin, that it appears that somebody from, was it Floyd County PD, was actually starting to post on Facebook about semi-incriminating factoids about Joey Watkins. It's interesting because this is the first glimmer of some sort of reaction from local law enforcement that we're hearing about.
Yeah, and I can say for both this case and our first season case, there have been a lot of people who are just, at least as far as we know, unconnected to law enforcement who have been sort of harassing various witnesses and people who might be witnesses either on appeal or a new trial. But yeah, this is the first time where actually someone involved in law enforcement in the jurisdiction has reached out to people listening to the podcast and presented, as we said in the episode, false information, where it was actually more character evidence. It was claiming that Joey had been involved in another incident. And as Susan laid out in the episode, it was false information that was being presented. So it's this continued effort to sort of support this conviction and claim it should stand after all these years. But again, it's that same technique they used at trial of piling on the character evidence as opposed to actually presenting evidence that Joy Watkins killed Isaac Dawkins.
Well, and I have to figure that police officers rationalize these kind of things. First of all, police officers are different than prosecutors. You know, police officers have to deal with the behavior on a daily basis, with criminal behavior. You know, they have to show up to work every day feeling like they're doing their job. And the vast majority are and are doing a perfectly terrific job, you know. But you can see their frustration because they're not really a part of the prosecutorial process. I empathize, but if you don't really have evidence...
Yeah, we have an issue like this that comes up in episode 8. I do have a problem, though, when some officers start to spread unsubstantiated stuff as though it's fact. That just drives me nuts. I wouldn't do it as a journalist. I certainly wouldn't think that somebody in law enforcement should do it. I mean, this is real life. It has repercussions.
And something that clearly the undisclosed team has kept in mind is, you know, you can't just throw around accusations. You know, obviously, Andy's case is unsolved. So you're looking for people who may well have committed this murder. Do you take that responsibility very seriously in terms of making sure that accusations aren't just being flung unresponsibly?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've been really, really careful. And, you know, a fraction of the stuff we've heard is actually included because we're making a point to make sure it holds up with other witnesses, that everything's cross-referenceable, that we can verify as much as possible. And we're certainly not just throwing stuff out there.
And Colin, you mentioned to me before we started the podcast, there was an article that you wanted to ask Amanda about.
Yeah, Amanda, I was fascinated because this is, I mean, so much in the news now. In fact, I just saw that Ohio, I think it was a judge in Columbus who was rejecting Ohio's challenge to the transgender bathroom policy. And I saw that in your history, you had worked on the Big Man on Campus piece, which I guess is your alma mater in Northern Kentucky. And could you share a bit about your work on that project?
So the Inquirer started diving more into transgender issues back in probably about 2014, right after a transgender girl by the name of Leela Alcorn committed suicide. She did it in a public manner, and it attracted international attention. She posted her suicide note to Tumblr, and, you know, the Inquirer just kind of looked at this. It's like this, you know, we need to start diving into some of these issues that transgender folks are facing. From what I've read, too, 30% of transgender youth report a history of at least one suicide attempt. So we highlighted a series of people over the course of a year who were battling some of these issues. And I talked to Daniel Jen, who had gone to Northern Kentucky University and had just been named president of his fraternity. So he allowed me to tag along for a week as he went through the whole rush process as president. And it was just I really enjoyed the project.
Now, being that he is a transgender man, did that affect his interactions on a daily basis? Because from the pictures in the article, he just looks like a guy. There is no, I imagine, you know, only students who are actually aware of that status would even bring it up. But you're in a frat atmosphere, which is a very charged atmosphere in terms of masculinity. Was it an issue that was discussed with any kind of frequency?
I think he would bring it up. He would tell people, and he made his story known. So he was a pretty well-known guy on campus. He had even once been named homecoming prince, I think, the year before. And I think the kids there at NKU really know Daniel's story, and just they embraced it.
Yeah, and I wonder, I mean, as someone who's never been to Cincinnati or that area, I wonder, because speaking more broadly and taking it to accused as well as with this Big Man on Campus that you did, you know, I always think of Cincinnati as a big Catholic city. And the piece of information I have is that the filet of fish from McDonald's was introduced there because it was the whole idea of not having meat on Friday. And I wonder,
Okay.
Brenna, right?
God bless you, Colin. God bless you for bringing that one up. I was wondering when that was going to come up.
But just in terms of both transgender issues and criminal justice, police, prosecution, et cetera, what do you think in terms of 1978 and 2016 of Cincinnati as a city in terms of both how receptive it is to transgender individuals, but also to these cases in the criminal justice system in terms of how the police are viewed and how the prosecution is viewed?
I think it's one of those 50-50 things. It just depends on who you talk to. And we don't read the comments. That's kind of the rule.
That's probably a good idea.
Especially on these types of stories. I think Amber has been the go-to comment reader on this because
I've got
she's just
skin.
Looking. Yeah, she's got thicker skin than I do.
She's aggressive. Yeah.
Exactly. She's aggressive.
But Oxford is significantly different than Cincinnati. So Cincinnati was actually my big story last year that was a lot of fun to cover was the gay marriage case at the Supreme Court. It was the first time I'd been to D.C. and I was in the courtroom for the arguments and stuff like that. And that was a Cincinnati case that was the namesake on that. This area is pretty progressive in terms of the city, but when you get up into some of the suburbs, it very quickly goes to more what you stereotypically think of when you think of Ohio.
Ben Roethlisberger. That's what I think of because he was.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, that's my
exact. That's exactly what I
mean. Well, it's interesting to me. Do you feel like the internet has quickened the pace of cultural change? Because, you know, there was a time when the Midwest, the New York and L.A. crowd always considered themselves on the vanguard of cultural change. And it just feels so not the case to me anymore. It seems like the United States, just all over the United States, is just erupting in cultural change all the time. Or is it that I'm just too sensitive to it?
No, I feel like that's true. I do. I also, the thing that worries me about how connected we are is just how quickly people can decide that things should be one way or that you said the wrong thing and they just come after you like a little digital mob. So that part I'm less comfortable with. But the upsides, I think, are that, you know, the forward thinking isn't just in the cities anymore, for sure.
Colin, did you have any more questions for Amanda and Amber?
Yeah, Amber, I was just wondering out of curiosity is, you know, you've written these true crime novels and you're doing the podcast now, but I also saw that you did the book on the Kennedy wives. And I was wondering if it was just something like you saw Grey Gardens and were really interested in the Kennedys or what was it that led you to do that project, which seems a little bit different from all the true crime stuff.
Lot of alcohol. You know, that one's kind of funny because my agent suggested it. It's not a very sexy story, but she was like, you know, I haven't seen a book on this and maybe you should do a pitch. And I was like, nobody's going to give me a book on the Kennedys. Sure, I'll do a pitch. And then I did a pitch and then it got accepted. And I was like, oh, crap. And so then I had to learn everything I could learn about all the Kennedy wives. And I actually ended up co-writing it with a guy, David Batra, I went to high school with. I'm best friends with his sister. So it ended up being like a really great personal project too. And then, gosh darn it, it landed on the bestsellers list for 1 week. But so in my obituary, it's going to say that I'm a bestseller because for 1 week I was.
And the other thing I noted, too, is I went to the University of Virginia for my undergrad. And so I know, obviously, you're investigating the Elizabeth Andes case, and that's Miami of Ohio and Oxford, Ohio. And one of the other books you did was the Yeardley Love case, the murder of the lacrosse player at UVA. And I'm wondering what led you to investigate that case and how you found Charlottesville and looking into everything surrounding lacrosse culture and Central Virginia.
I was drawn to Yeardley's case because it did appear from the get-go to be a domestic violence or dating violence case. But she wasn't the type of victim that you usually see portrayed. She was from a great family, very wealthy, smart as hell. She was an athlete, so she was very strong, yet she still fell victim to this. And that's why I wanted to tell that story. It ended up being much more difficult because all of the money surrounding that case and the Virginia Freedom of Information Act laws are abysmal. So I didn't get to tell the story that I wanted to, frankly, in that book. But her case really did resonate with me. So hopefully I at least got to shine some light on DV issues there.
In a general sense, what was the story you did want to tell?
I wanted to talk about how somebody who didn't match the typical DV persona, the victim persona, could still end up in one of these terrible relationships. And it happens all the time. And I think it's important for young women to realize that it can happen to you, and this is what you need to look out for, and these are the consequences of ignoring some of the red flags. I think it's an important story to tell still. I'm happy, though, that her family has really, when I talked to her mom the first time she said, oh, Yardley was no shrinking violet. So they were kind of distancing themselves from her being a DV victim. And I was like, yeah, but a lot of these women aren't shrinking violets. That's kind of the point, you know. But now they have a foundation and they're much more embracing of that. And they're working with young women. So I'm happy to see that evolution.
And it can happen to young men as well. I'm not being defensive.
Absolutely.
I don't know what.
No.
I'm just saying it happens to some people.
It totally does. And that's the thing. When you have a certain persona in your head, then you dismiss all of the other stories. And that's not fair because it can happen to all kinds of people.
The question, Amanda, that I have for you is, and I'll say just if I haven't mentioned it before, is this is an awesome podcast. I'm truly addicted to it. If you haven't listened to it yet, the only recommendation I have is to find maybe a 5 or so hour block of time, because once you start listening, you're not going to be able to stop. But Amanda, with your background being in photojournalism and multimedia and all that, was there ever any thought at the beginning of this being more of a Making a Murder style documentary, or what was it that led to the idea that this would be an audio podcast as opposed to a documentary?
As far as the documentary goes, I'm still finalizing the video component to this project as we speak. So there will be a video component, but it not necessarily in the documentary form, just because I was without so much of this archival footage that maybe once was. And with it being 37 years ago, there's only so much B-roll of Oxford that, you know, I could shoot to go along with it. But we do have plenty of video interviews. Most of the interviews that you'll hear with Amber, with talking with her friends, with Bob, I actually took video footage of. So that's been on our website too. And telling this, you had to hear these people's voices. You had to, you know, listening to the interviews, they're so compelling that it was kind of a no-brainer to do it in a podcast form.
Once we knew that we would have enough voices to make it come alive, we thought this would be the right way to tell the story.
And without giving too much away now, I mean, it's had, what is it, episodes 5 and 6 especially, focusing on alternate suspects, et cetera. Do you think that you're any closer to figuring out the identity of her murder, or is it still something where it's very much a bunch of leads and nothing too concrete?
I think we've given police a lot to work with, and I don't think that it's out of reach. The frustrating part, of course, is I am a journalist. I can't get a search warrant. I can't do any kind of citizen's arrest without more info, but I did at least make a point to keep law enforcement in the loop on what I found. And so they're aware.
And I think I saw, right, most recently, maybe this is just a day or two ago, they're still holding the position of this is a closed case, we're not going to investigate, right?
Well, not exactly. So it depends on which entity you're talking about. And that's one of the frustrating things is how political and how divided it all gets. We should all be searching for the truth in this. So it shouldn't matter if it's the Butler County Sheriff's Office or the, you know, state AG's office or whatever. What I had posted was that it's still not listed as a cold case in Butler County, and it's still not listed as a cold case in the state of Ohio. And for us, it's kind of symbolic because her family's been asking for it to be listed. What that means to other people is that if they are searching, if they remember, like, there was this tidbit and I was too afraid to come forward, if they search for Elizabeth Andes, they don't see a place to leave that tip. And to me, that's horrible. And the reason for it is because the prosecutor still believes that he had fingered the right guy way back when. So we do know that our work has prompted police to start looking again, but there are still some symbolic things, at least, that they could do to let the family know, yes, we hear you, this is unsolved. And that was one of the reasons we chose the name we did. We very specifically called this the unsolved murder of Elizabeth Andes. That was intentional.
Well, the last thing I'll just say is, I mean, I know you have your email, right? So if one of you could just say the email address for people, if they have information, if they're listening and they are in the area and have awareness of the case, how can they contact you?
Absolutely. You can reach us at accused@enquire.com. I'm reporter Amber on Twitter. Amanda?
ArussmanZero2.
And keep it clean, people.
Yeah.
Keep it clean. There.
That's all right. I can take it.
Well, thank you guys so much for coming to the show. I'm really enjoying the podcast. I am not as far along in it as Colin is, but I've got to drive to work. So, all right.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
And Colin, thanks to you as well. Always a pleasure. And actually, thank you for tweeting that link to the video from the excerpt from Hiding Out. was that actually your sister in the roller rink?
My sister was the roller skating limbo champion. I've probably seen Hiding Out at least 6 or 7 times.
At the behest of your sister?
Before I grew about 6 inches in the summer, I was actually like a limbo champion. But then I grew... closer to my present height and...
of 7'8" or
yes,
whatever it
yes.
is.
No, no longer. I used to be very good at actual limbo before I had that growth spurt.
Well, thank you to your sister. Can you pass that on for me? And just a little tidbit. She might remember that when I fall down in the scene and it's like, ha ha, he fell down and he knocked over Annabeth Gish. Ha ha. I actually injured her. I want to apologize to Annabeth Gish and apologize to the world that we made light of her injury. Well, thank you guys again. And I think we're done for this week's addendum. So that's all we got for this week's addendum. Now, every week doing this show, I'm reminded that there are hardworking lawyers at innocence centers all over the U.S. And honestly, I should be highlighting them all. But since we've only got 9 more episodes, that would be a surefire way to do none of them justice. So I'm going to urge you to try to find one in your area and see if there's any way you can help volunteer or donate. And this week, I will be donating my fee to the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center. They are a nonprofit organization working to correct and prevent the wrongful conviction of innocent people in Utah, Nevada, and Wyoming. The RMIC is the only organization in the region providing innocence, investigation, and litigation services entirely for free. They were recommended to us by Hillary Kay, and their web address is rminnocence.org. So do check them out and donate if you can. Fans can discuss the show on Twitter at #undisclosed or #justiceforjoey. If you want to tag questions for future addenda, you should probably just send them to me and use the #UDAddendum. My Twitter address is @MrJohnCryer. And also, if you've got more worthy organizations, let me know. I actually am running out. I need a few more for the last few episodes of the show, and I do donate to them specifically, so they would probably be grateful for that. Probably. And as always, there will be new case documents and photos posted at the undisclosed-podcast.com website. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the handle @UndisclosedPod, and also our key partner, the Georgia Innocence Project @GAInnocence. I'm going to thank Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media for audio production today. Rebecca and her husband, Kevin, have a new podcast called These Are Their Stories, which is, of course, a podcast about the seminal American crime procedural Law and Order. And I got to do the podcast last week, which was more fun than a barrel of monkeys. So if you feel like checking that out, please do. It's called These Are Their Stories. And I'm going to give a shout out to Patrick Cortez once again for composing the addenda theme. Still loving it. And of course, Methil Telon, who is our project manager. I am so grateful for all the work she does every week. And thank you once again for listening to the Undisclosed Addendum. It's been a real pleasure, and I can't wait to talk to you again next week.
I'm going to be a total dork and tell you that my sister Missy and I used to dance along to Pretty in Pink all the time. So, hi!
Hi. Oh,
all right, that's guys, cool. I'm here too.
Isn't that dork? Oh. We've all had that moment with John. Yes. Don't worry about it. It's better just to get it out early.
I probably still know the dance moves, just so you know.
Wow. To the dance in the record store?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. wow. Well, thank you. I'm so glad you enjoyed it. That whole soundtrack was amazing, actually.
Right?
Right? you know, even though I had nothing to do with actually compiling the soundtrack, it allowed me to feel I was a member of those bands for a little while. I had no right to feel that way. They did not know me. They had no idea who I was.
No, but you had the moves.
Exactly. So I had the moves.